there's a lot of people getting involved in this that now that I think they're seeing a false picture. You have to realize, I always say that I don't care what you're hunting, everything has to be taken in perspective. Everybody likes to think that whatever they're hunting, wherever they're hunting it, that's the hardest thing. And I'm not trying to come off that way. If you are in northern Florida and you decide you want to bow hunt, and all of the stuff you're seeing on social media are these guys killing these giant whitetails, that's probably not going to be your experience. At the root of it, I think that certain interests attract different personalities. And I think overall, traditional bow hunters are a lot more enthralled with the entire process, right?
This is the Food Afield podcast, a show about wild food ingredients and how to collect them. And now, broadcasting from the wilds of Alberta, is your host, John David Schneider.
I purposefully kept you a little bit out of the loop because I wanted your fresh take on a few things, okay. Not to ambush you, but just to give your unfettered thought to or comments to a few things. So
sure.
I think to get started, Ethan, I'd just like to know a little bit about you and your background. I'd love to know about your podcast, The Stick Boys. I've listened to your show. In fact, I just went back and listened to your show, and it might have been from a couple of years ago with Clay Hayes.
Yeah.
That was a great one. Oh, so anyways, I love your show.
Oh, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're doing really good things with the traditional bow hunting. So,
well, I appreciate
tell me it. A little bit. So, first of all, pronounce your name. Is it Roderick?
Yeah, it's Roderick. So,
Roderick.
Yeah. So, I was. Everybody thinks it's Rodriguez, but I was actually born in South Louisiana and raised there, and that's actually a somewhat common name down there. And
really,
yeah. It's kind of a long story, but it's just a French pronunciation of Rodriguez. I've kind of gotten to the point now where I'll answer to whatever. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, but exactly.
But
well, that's an interesting topic in and of itself, Louisiana and the Bayou and all that sort of stuff. The Canadian connection, yep. with regards to that, or the New France connection, at least anyways.
So. Absolutely.
So where are you now, Ethan?
So I live in Southeast Tennessee. I live on the Cumberland Plateau. When I left, I've probably been in Tennessee. Actually, I have been in Tennessee longer than I spent in Louisiana. I got out of the military. I met my wife while I was in the military. She was not, but we met, and she's from Tennessee. So we moved here in, I guess, 97 when I got out. So yeah, we've been here longer, so this is home, and try not to. I do miss the food, and I miss some friends and family, but outside of that, I do not miss the heat. And I'll be honest with you, John, I have spent every day in a swamp that I plan on spending for the rest of my life. So unless it's in a northern climate chasing moose, I have no intention on being in a swamp again. So
there you go. No, I don't think I could argue with you about that at all. I've been in enough swamps too. Not the temperate kind that you're talking about, but yeah,
miserable.
So Ethan, tell me about your podcast, The Stick Boys. How did that go? What's the history of that? I've actually, researched it, trying to figure out, and I haven't come across any information. How did that all get started?
Well, I was involved with another podcast previously, and that all kind of went away, kind of went south. And at the time, I was on council for PBS as a councilman, and I had just gotten off council. And Matt Schuster, who is the outgoing president or former president of PBS, we were in Springfield, Missouri, and he said, "Man, now that you're off of bank council," he said, "I don't really want to ask you to do a podcast, but I really wish you'd do a podcast." And I said, "Man, I don't know if I want to do it. It's fun, but if I do it, I want to do it with somebody because it's just funner that way. It's more fun." I wanted to co-host it with somebody who was kind of like-minded, and like, we have no inclination to be in the industry. That's not what we do. We don't talk about gear. We don't talk about whatever. We just, and we get questions a lot about gear, but that's just not what we do. That's not what's important. I mean, there's a lot of good gear out there now, and it makes our life easier, but we just try to focus on woodsmanship. And we're just a couple of knuckleheads that just are ate up with hunting stuff with a traditional bow, man. And that's kind of where it starts and ends right there, you know? So we started the podcast, and luckily, or thankfully with PBS, and there's so many good connections that have made over the years of being involved with the organization. And I know some really, really great bow hunters who have done a lot and accomplished a lot just from PBS. So, we like to keep the idea in mind that people, we realize fully that people listen to the podcast because they want to hear our guests, not us. So, you know, we try not to talk too much and just let people go, you know, let people talk. And that's who they're listening for anyway. So that's kind of how we approach it.
You're telling lots of stories about bow hunting. You're telling lots of, you know, anecdotes and little tidbits of information that people can glean from that. Mm-hmm. Hey, first of all, let's back up a bit because this will be a slightly different audience for you.
Okay.
I don't speak specifically about traditional bow hunting. Right, right. And a lot of my audience is brand new to things. So what is the PBS?
Okay. So the PBS is an organization, it's the Professional Bowhunter Society, and some people get hung up on the word professional. It is not in any way, shape, or form does it have anything to do with getting paid to bow hunt. It's quite the opposite. It's just a professional attitude and seriousness and passion of how we approach bow hunting as far as ethics in the field, doing the right thing, and just trying to be a good ambassador for bow hunting. The organization is actually 60 years old.
Yeah.
And it was started back about around the 50s. There were a lot of field archery was gaining a lot of traction, right? And there were a lot of bow hunting organizations around the country, local clubs. And I don't want to use the word infiltrated, but they were getting a lot of new members that were very, very centric to field archery. And there were people in the country that thought, man, you know, these clubs are, they're changing the direction here. This isn't about bow hunting anymore. It's about competitive field archery, which is fine. But they wanted to start an organization that was absolutely 100% bow hunting. So that's how it got started. That's how it's evolved. Kind of tongue in cheek, but the way I always try to explain it is if you watch the Outdoor Channel or whatever, like none of them people are in PBS, right? There are no egos involved in PBS, none whatsoever.
No, I never get that impression. And of course, to back up and give people a little bit of history behind that as well, you know, well, why would there be the need to focus on traditional bow hunting back in the 50s? And that was a big deal, wasn't it, back then?
It was a very big deal because, you know, a lot of states didn't have bow. It's an interesting topic that you bring up. Bow seasons haven't been around really that long in the grand scheme of things. I mean, there are many people alive today who were alive before, and I'm not talking 80-year-old men here, but, you know, don't quote me on the dates, but I want to say Wisconsin was the first state to have a bow season, and it was like in the late 40s or maybe early 50s. So there wasn't much in the way of bow hunting. And if you wanted to bow hunt, if you didn't know someone personally who bow hunted, there wasn't a lot of information out there. So it was a really good source for networking and connecting to people and that type of thing. So it did play a critical role. When Fred Bear came along, he popularized bow hunting, you know, be a two season hunter, that type of thing. But prior to that, man, if you wanted to do this, you'd have to know somebody who made bows and made arrows
and broadheads and how to stalk and all sorts of stuff.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Tree stands and
you bet.
Super valuable organization back in the day. Why is it valuable today?
Well, when I was on council, that was several years ago as a councilman, we actually just had our elections, and I'm the oncoming vice president of PBS now. So what we're doing now is a little different than what it was a few years ago. It's kind of evolved a little bit for the better. There's a lot of information that people can get online. I mean, you can go on forums or whatever. You never really know who you're talking to. You gotta weed a lot of that stuff out. But PBS is an organization that I've said many times, it's really hard to explain. And I feel like you could explain the organization for hours and someone would have an idea. But if you ever attend a banquet or go to a gathering or whatever, you instantly realize what it is. And it really is like a family. Matt Schuster always jokes and said, it's just like a family reunion, except everyone likes each other. And that's very true. Right. And And when you go to these things, every banquet I've been involved with on council, you know, one of the common things we hear from the hotel staff is like, man, y'all are the hugginest group of people I've ever seen. And, you know, y'all are just really easy to work with because we're just there to visit with old friends. And, you know, I mean, we're a bunch of bow hunters. We don't really care if the hotel could have had nicer carpet or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Not that that's an issue. We've always had really good hotels that we pick. And we have a banquet every other year and it moves throughout the country. So it's typically in the middle-ish part of the country, and then it'll move to the eastern side of the country, and then back in the middle, and then back to the western side. So it's somewhat easy for people to get to at least every few banquets. The only bad thing about a banquet, man, is they just go so fast. They're just...
I haven't been to one yet. You know, it's just, I was talking with somebody about this the other day, and you guys in the States are so lucky. I mean, you have 10 times the population that we do, and that sounds weird to say, but therefore, you just have a more concentration of whatever community it is that you belong to, right? Yeah. There's always going to be something close by that you can do or join. And up here in Northern Canada, it's a bit of a hike to get anywhere. So I feel left out of the loop. I feel like the unpopular kid, you know, but anyways.
I will tell you this though, John, there is one more drawback. If you ever go to a banquet, you will do everything in your power not to miss another one.
I've heard that.
I'm very
good friend of mine.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
A good friend of mine is Jeff Lander. You had him on your show not that long ago. Jeff and I go back way back. So, yeah, he says the same thing about, a few like PBS and a few different organizations. Yeah. He said the same thing to me. Yeah.
Yeah. It's great.
PBS then, as far as a new traditional bow hunter would go, PBS is a great organization to get involved with for a few reasons, but one of them would just be, I heard you in that Clay Hayes interview. Mm-hmm. You said something, or maybe it was Dalton, but you said something about back in the day, the forums used to be that, you know, if you broke a limb or something bad happened to you while you're bow hunting, somebody would just send you a bow. And, that's what the PBS sort of reminds me of, is that you could, you know, you could go on to the PBS forums and you could say, you know, hey, I need a hand with literally anything. And there'd be guys falling over themselves to help you out. And,
100%.
You know, I've seen evidence of that. Yeah, it's a good organization. So I would encourage anybody out there that's getting interested in traditional bow hunting to definitely check out the PBS. And then, of course, the other one, which you and I are both involved in to a certain degree, is promoting the Traditional Bowhunter magazine.
Oh, yeah.
That's another great resource. They've evolved over the years. It used to be, well, I don't know. I shouldn't speak to that, really. I mean, I've been getting that magazine for decades now, but they sure have started to focus a bit more on tips and tricks and different things to help, you know, new people get started. So, anyways, those are two good, valuable resources. And then the other valuable resource, of course, is your show, Stick Boys. So your thrust then with the show is mainly to, what is your thrust for the show?
Well, we just really want people to realize, for lack of a better way to say it, just how cool traditional bow hunting is, you know, and there's a lot of, new interest in traditional bow hunting, which is awesome. There was a big surge back in the 90s, and there is one again now. And I think a lot of people with social media, it's kind of a double-edged sword, I suppose. But there's a lot of people getting involved in this that I think they're seeing a false picture. You know what I mean? And you have to realize, I always say that I don't care what you're hunting or what you're after, whatever. Everything has to be taken in perspective. You know what I mean? So everybody likes to think that whatever they're hunting, wherever they're hunting it, that's the hardest thing. And I'm not trying to come off that way, but you know, if you are in Northern Florida and you decide you want to bow hunt, and all of the stuff you're seeing on social media are these guys killing these giant whitetails in Iowa, right? That's probably not going to be your experience, you know? And at the root of it, it's funny because I had a conversation today with a friend of mine, but at the root of it, I think that certain hobbies or interests attract different personalities. And I think overall traditional bow hunters in general are a lot more, not necessarily concerned, but a lot more enthralled with the entire process, right? It's not, yeah. It's not just, absolutely. Yeah, it's the whole thing that goes with it. You know what I mean? And I'm trying to remember who it was that was on the podcast. And I think it was Scott Kelzer actually from Montana. And he said that, and this is a perfect analogy of that. They were at a Montana bow hunters banquet years ago. And he looks over and it was back in the '80s, I believe. And he's like, man, there's, you know, Gene and Barry Wentzel and Paul Schaefer, and, you know, just some really heavy hitters. And everybody was just sitting around after the banquet talking. And he said, what struck him was everybody's stories they were telling were not about when they killed the biggest this or the best that.
They never are, no, right?
It was all about these crazy mishaps and these crazy adventures and these animals that they never did tag, because it is more process oriented. And I think that's that speaks volumes in my mind to what most traditional bow hunters, their personalities. And I think it's important for people coming into that to be able to, you know, kind of connect with that. And not everything is roses and peaches, and, you know, not everybody's going to have, you know, hunt with the traditional bow for 1 year and you kill four Pope and young animals. It's not the way it works unless you're in very specific circumstances.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you, man. You know, it's funny because I try to portray that balance, right? I've shown pictures of my broadhead that's filled with, you know, clay because I went under a deer or whatever. Like, I mean, I certainly have more mishaps than triumphs, right? As we all do. Sure. And they're not even mishaps, because nowadays, as I get older, I'm just learning to love these, you know, missed opportunities or failures, if you want to call them that. I just, you know, for a bunch of different reasons that I've talked about several times on my show. But what's frustrating to me, though, is still when you do connect with that big whitetail or that big bear or whatever it is, those are the moments, whether it's a podcast story or an Instagram post or something like that, those are always the content that gets the most attention, the most everything, right? So it is a double-edged sword, because I mean, it's cool. I mean, if Ethan slams a big whitetail, everybody's happy and excited for that. But, you know, a couple of years ago, I was looking for a fawn. I wanted a fawn. I wanted a small amount of venison. I was trying to target a fawn. And then when I was successful doing it, you know, it was a big deal to me, right? But anyways, I don't even know what I'm trying to say. I agree with you that the message out there for anybody getting started would be, you know, I see this all the time on posts too. Like, I know it's not the biggest buck, but
yeah, I hate right? that.
Well, if you're starting posts with that, then
yeah,
like, dude, no, that's awesome. If you're excited about harvesting that animal, and that's a big achievement. It doesn't matter to shoot a big buck or a fawn. They're basically the same level of achievement as far as, you know, sneaking up on a wild animal, right?
100%. Like, you know, that young doe or that fawn or whatever, you know, insert whatever animal, that animal's life wasn't worth any less than
exactly
a bigger animal. And if, you know, yeah. in the same token, as if you've been doing it long enough and you want the additional challenge and you hold out for that, that's awesome too, right? Mm-hmm. Just hunt for you and hunt for the right reasons. And it's kind of a, you know, Michael Arnett is a good friend of mine at Tall Times, and he and I talk a lot about this type of stuff. And it's hard to say exactly what those right reasons are. So I can't say, John, the right reasons to hunt are this, but I can tell you that you should hunt for the right reasons, right? And you got to discover what that is. But, you know, getting attention on social media should not be anywhere near the list of why you do this.
Yeah, I agree. How did you get started in traditional bow hunting, Ethan?
Well, my dad has always been a bow hunter. And growing up, I tell people, I honest to goodness, I cannot tell you the first bow that I had, because I've just always had a bow. The first real bow I had, still have it. It was a Ben Pearson Bronco, little recurve, but still got that bow. But growing up, we used to bow fish all the time and shoot them just always out in the woods flinging arrows, right? And we shot compounds and everything too. And then about the time I left for the military, my dad got really, really into it, And it's kind of an interesting story because when I got out of the military, he got into making bows and he made me one. And I was like, man, this is really cool. One of these days, right? I'm going to pursue this. This is going to be really cool one of these days. And so in the late 90s, Glenn St. Charles came out with Bows of the Little Delta.
Oh, I love that book.
Me too. I've read it many times. And Dad sent me a copy of it. And like 2 weeks later, I'm like, hey, and I was living up here at the time, but I'm like, I'm coming down and I'm going to make a bow. And he's like, well, slow down. I'm like, no, I'm going to make a bow. So worked all night, drove down there. And interestingly enough, I was trying to catch a cat nap at my mom and dad's house in South Louisiana on the couch, and the phone rings. I'm waiting on my dad to get back so we can do this marathon bow building session. Right. And I hear my mom tell someone on the phone, hey, he'll be home later, blah, 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 and hangs up. And she said, hey, when your dad gets back, he needs to call this guy. I was like, who was it? She's like, it's some old man named Glenn St. Charles. And I shot up and I was like, what? Like, somebody named Glenn St. Charles. And I'm like, you're kidding. And I called Dad and he didn't believe me. But what had happened is Dad hadn't, at the time, we had never met him. And Dad just wrote him a letter, you know, hey, really enjoyed your book, gave the book to my son. He really enjoyed it. And now he's like full tilt and he's obsessed with it. So Glenn, this is way back before computers and or internet anyways. And he took it on himself to get the contact information, and he called. So he called that night and we chatted for probably an hour on the phone, and that really solidified things. And I was like,
no way.
This is really cool.
I never met Glenn and I never talked to him, and I wish I had. And so you're so lucky. Such a, just shows you what kind of guy he was. And,
absolutely.
And I don't even think that would be unusual for the people that he hung out with, right? You absolutely know, just not. Everybody's kind of like that.
Absolutely.
All right. So the real thrust of what I wanted to talk to you here was that I am a little bit of a conflict over some of the things that I talk about when it comes to, you know, getting people started in traditional bow hunting. And to me, it seems weird. It shouldn't be a conflict at all, but I'm anxious for your opinion. So what is your opinion on getting more people involved in traditional bow hunting, especially in a country that has, you know, close to half a billion people in it?
That is an interesting question. And I've had this conversation a lot, and it's kind of like that, you know, hunt for the right reasons. I don't know if you could really define it. I think that I've always been of the mindset that I'm all about having more people who are understanding and pro hunting, not necessarily more hunters, you know?
there you go. Yeah.
And I think that there again with that false picture, people get into bow hunting expecting one thing and they don't realize how difficult it's going to be. So I think like with this surge that we're seeing, I think there's going to be a little bit of attrition there. Because I think a lot of people are getting into this because, oh, it's the cool thing to do or what have you, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. If that's what you want to do, that's wonderful. But, you know, we go back to that personality type. And I think that at least a percentage of the people that are picking up a traditional bow now may or may not want to hang around. And that's fine because not everybody needs to do that. I totally get it. Not everybody has the time to dedicate to shooting a traditional bow to go be consistent and ethical hunting with it. But I think it's a slippery slope because, you know, we always hear these numbers tossed around like, you know, hunter numbers are going down. Well, obviously, everywhere you go, access is getting harder and harder and things are getting more crowded. I had a conversation with my son-in-law just the other day. He stopped and asked someone that doesn't live far from us. He's asked two or three people in the last couple of weeks for permission to hunt. And I'm like, man, I admire that. I've done a lot of that myself. But at this point in life, I'm just about convinced that if it can be hunted, someone's already hunting it or it's already leased up. So more and more people are having to hunt public, which you can have some great experiences hunting public ground, but you can also have some frustrating experiences, and it's getting more and more crowded. So I don't really know what the answer is, but I think overall, for what it's worth, I would like to see more better hunters and not quite so many more hunters. You know, in other words, people that are passionate about it and they want to give back and they want to leave bow hunting and hunting in general better than they found it, I'm all for them people. People that want to use it as a tool just to get likes or whatever, pimp stuff out, that kind of sticks in my craw a little bit, you know.
Mm-hmm. Understandable. And, you know, so there's a difference in perspective, right? Because up here in Canada, we have, you know, even more land mass and 1/10 the population. Mm-hmm. So there is zero shortage of places to hunt. I mean, gosh, you can go, I can drive within 5 minutes of my house and knock on a door and ask permission to hunt and, you know, probably have a 50% chance of being told yes. Wow. And then we're, you know, completely surrounded with crown land where even if I exhaust the three people that I asked to hunt, I can go up and hunt, you know, crown land somewhere, right? So, you know, good for me, yay. But down in the States, that is a different thing. Mm-hmm. The thing I always think about with regards to when I'm sort of promoting, is that the right word? Promoting folks to get into hunting and fishing. You know, we can even set aside traditional bow hunting. I mean, and this is the traditional bow hunter's journey, so I do want to talk about that. But when I talk about getting people involved in hunting and fishing, I'm always approaching it from the standpoint, well, the more people that hunt and fish, the more people there are that can volunteer for boards and volunteer for school boards and run for office and create legislation that maybe, I mean, one of the things I think about is all the urban deer hunting opportunities that would exist if it were ever opened up. So does any of that sort of play into things? I mean, I see all the time news reaches us here in Canada, down the States, with different closures or different bills coming across to close this or close that. Do you think it's a good idea to, especially guys our age, to start getting involved? I mean, you already are. Do you think it's a good thing? Should we run for office and should we start trying to manipulate these hunting opportunities?
Heritage, lifestyle, community. We at Traditional Bowhunter Magazine strive to provide the best traditional experience for you. Our goal is to encourage a welcoming community focused on a lifestyle that honors the heritage of the traditional bow. In the bi-monthly magazine issues, you can read about hunts in faraway places and close to home, wild game cooking, how-tos, technique advice, beginner-friendly articles, and wisdom from our beloved experts. You will also find businesses that have the tools you need to get out into the woods. Want to start reading now? Download the app and enjoy the digital magazine for $10 a year. Just search Traditional Bowhunter Magazine in your favorite app store. Want a print subscription? Subscribe online at tradbow.com and don't forget to place the code FOODAFIELD at the checkout. Traditional Bowhunter Magazine, bringing the traditional community together since 1989.
I absolutely do. I think that's where the more quote unquote better hunters comes in. And I think, you know, as we get older, we have more time that we can dedicate to things and we can pursue things a little more passionately because our kids are grown or what have you.
Yeah.
And I do think it's important to be involved. Another thing I think that goes hand in hand in that is getting back to the perspective thing, everything's different. So depending on where you go. So here, just for instance, in Tennessee, you've got East Tennessee, Middle Tennessee, and West Tennessee. And those are very different areas to, you know, from a topographical standpoint. And the animal numbers are different. There are places in the state where it's just an unbelievable amount of whitetail does you can take. Like you can literally kill, and I've said it before, you can kill 3 does a day. From the opening day of bow season to the last day of rifle season. If you can physically do it, you can legally do it because there's so many deer. Now, where I'm at, that is not the case whatsoever. The numbers are a lot lower. But the point I'm getting at is if you're managing as a biologist, I'm assuming, you know, if you're managing like the deer herds in Middle Tennessee, you're not as necessarily concerned about does the crossbow belong in bow season so much as we don't care, just kill deer. Now, as a machinist, not a biologist, I look at that as, you know, if you want to increase the numbers of animals taken, make the seasons longer, but don't dumb down the existing seasons we have. And that's a whole different argument. But then you go out west and that is not the case. It is not a situation where we want you to kill as much as possible. It's more of a situation where how are we going to manage the opportunity for people? So what I'm getting at is the situations in Utah is different than the situation in Arizona and Maryland and Tennessee and wherever. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important that people get involved at a state level for sure. And then utilize the resources like the PBS and Compton's and these other organizations to help out specifically, because that's not like a one size fits all answer, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. I mean, it makes total sense, but it's funny. I was a little oblivious to that sort of thing. So to hear you talk about even Tennessee being so radically different in such a short geographical area, that's fascinating.
Yeah,
I've referenced it a couple times now, good hunter. So maybe you've alluded to what you mean by that. I think you have, but like, what's your definition of that? And what, so somebody new that's listening to this podcast, and I don't want to disappoint Ethan, what am I trying to accomplish by, you know, by how should I conduct myself?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's important for anybody hunting. I don't care what kind of hunting you're doing. And I've said this before many times, but whether you agree with what I'm about to say, whether you think it's dumb, it's irrelevant. If you hunt, you are an ambassador for hunting. Whether you want to be or not, it's completely irrelevant. And, you know, for instance, poachers, I would say, and I don't know the exact numbers, but I would say easily 80% of the poachers are caught by hunters turning them in, right? And there's nothing that, in my opinion, a true hunter disdains more than someone who poaches, right? Because it's unethical, they're stealing, and it's not fair to the game animals. But the general public, when they see a guy shoot something out of a window, they don't think, there goes a poacher. They think, there goes a hunter. So yeah. I think it's vitally important to always conduct yourself in a professional manner. I totally get the attitude, you know, with it doesn't matter what you think. It's my right. I'm going to do it. Okay, I get that. But at the end of the day, the people that are going to make the decisions on this, and we're seeing this escalating as far as the grizzly seasons up there in British Columbia and bear hunting in Colorado, lion hunting in Washington State, the people making the people making those decisions, they don't have any idea about hunting or how nature works or anything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you got, I think the numbers are a little less than 10% of the population here in America hunts. A little less than that is against hunting. That other 80%, they don't really care. But ultimately, they're the ones that's going to make the decisions.
I just looked up that stat.
Yeah.
And more than they don't really care, it was a study. I'd have to go back. I posted about it a couple months ago now, so I forget where it came from, but it was a reputable sort of study. Mm-hmm. And it said that over 70% of Americans approved of hunting.
Yeah.
So I thought that was staggering.
Yeah.
I was like, I wasn't expecting that at all.
But I think the caveat to that, what I've always read it, was they approve of hunting if the meat is being utilized, right? And that's a prime example because people talk about, well, I'm not like trophy hunters. Man, I don't know that I can name someone who hunts and cuts the heads off and could absolutely care about less about the meat. I mean, everybody, you know, define trophy, right?
Certainly not traditional bow hunters.
No, absolutely not. It's too hard to come by. But, you know, if you look at, you know, we just have to portray ourselves in a positive way. And I had a conversation with a lady one time, and she actually asked me, how can I claim to love animals if I kill them, right? Mm-hmm. And the way I explained it was, look, you know, and her next question backing up was, how would you like it if I shot you with an arrow? And my response was, that would suck, right? I hope I get to die peacefully surrounded by my family, right? But if you're an ungulate, man, that option's not on the table, right? You're going to, you know, get a disease or starve, or you're going to watch yourself be eaten alive by a predator until you finally lose enough blood. That's your only options. If those are your only options, an arrow might not be a bad way to go. And then, you know, I brought out the point. I'm like, well, you know, you say we're talking about whitetails. It's like, well, you say you love whitetails. She says, well, absolutely. I'm like, so what's their gestation period? You know, when do they breed? What do they need to survive? How many fawns does a doe typically have? You know, when does a buck lose? She knew none of that stuff. I'm like, okay, so you like the idea of these animals, but you know nothing about them. So how much money have you spent in conservation? How many how many pounds of mineral have you packed into the woods when it's 100 degrees in August and you're packing stuff down some mountainside choked in with mountain laurel, knowing that that deer could care less about that mineral when hunting season comes along, but it's going to help them out, right? So you almost get that Walt Disney mentality. You know, people, they love Bambi. They love the daddy bears, the mama bears. They don't realize that those daddy bears kill those baby bears to get the mama bears to breed again, you know. And I honestly think that it's pretty easy to have a conversation with a rational thinking person. And I'm not talking about the far hardcore anti-hunters, but just the average person who doesn't know about hunting and doesn't necessarily approve of it. It's really easy to have an intelligent conversation with that person and convince them of the importance of hunting and the biological facts and the benefits of hunting and how much you love and care for these animals. It isn't hard to do that if you can talk with just a little bit of knowledge about it. It doesn't take much at all. And I think hunters have failed miserably in that. The Robertson-Pittman Act, I would wager that probably 60% of the hunters in North America couldn't tell you what the Robertson-Pittman Act is. And that's like one of the biggest, shiniest bullets we need to have in the gun when it comes to defending hunting. I think everybody who hunts has the responsibility to inform yourself a little bit and be able to speak intelligently on it and give back as much as possible. Because if we don't do it, man, it's not going to happen, you know?
Everything you said, hard yes. And then the other thing too is we have an election coming up here in Alberta right now. You guys have an election, what, next year, a federal election? Mm-hmm. You know, I guess part of that education can go towards, you know, being in touch with the people that represent you in government and knowing what their stance is, or at least sharing what your opinion could be on it.
Sure.
So that's part of that intellect that needs to occur when it comes to hunting. Because I mean, I'm a little worried. I'm 56 years old and I've seen things and I've seen how things have changed. You're not that far behind me, but it's the difference between being born in the 60s and being born in the 70s. And so I've seen a lot of changes.
Absolutely.
To both our wildlife populations and how we handle them, not to mention all the other weird stuff that's going on in the world.
Hey folks, it's Mark Hall, host of the Hunter Conservationist Podcast in Cranbrook, British Columbia. Join co-host Curtis and I as we have nuanced conversations with scientists, First Nation leaders, hunters, trappers, book authors, and biologists about wildlife science, conservation, and responsible hunting in Canada. You can find the Hunter Conservationist Podcast wherever you download podcasts.
You don't talk about gear all that much, but I am curious what you would say to somebody who was thinking about getting started in traditional bow hunting. I would be curious, maybe as it relates to your area and where you hunt, and then later on we'll get into what you hunt and how you hunt. So how does somebody get started? You know, they're in the Midwest. What do they do?
I think the best thing you could do is to seek out someone who is willing to help you. And just going that same line of thought, you know, bow hunters are just kind of geared a little different. If you show genuine interest that you want to learn something, most guys doing this are going to step over anything they can to help you. I think the best thing a person can do if they want to be a hunter is find someone, get plugged into an organization like PBS, Compton, state organizations, whatever you can, and just show interest, be respectful. Don't try to portray yourself as something you aren't, and just listen and be willing to be coachable. Right. And I think most people, like I said, will go way, way above and beyond to help you out in any way, shape or form. And I think the best thing you could do to be a successful hunter is, you know, anything you can do to help yourself with woodsmanship skills, the better off you're going to be. And, you know, that's actually one thing that I did write an article for a couple for traditional bow hunter magazines. And that's one of the things that I hit on one of those articles is, you know, you can't wrap up woodsmanship in a shiny package and sell it. So nobody's really talking about it. Right. Mm-hmm. But all of those things you go out and buy, some of them can help you. A lot of them can't. But the only thing that's going to improve your hunting skills is woodsmanship skills. That's it. Now, you
give me an example of what you're talking about, Ethan, for somebody that might not know. What do you mean by woodsmanship?
Well, you have everything from, you know, wind thermals and wind currents and weather and what animals need at certain times of the year. So you break it down into food sources, right? Greenbrier is a staple for whitetails where I live. Deer are not focusing on greenbriers when there's acorns available. When there's fresh spring grasses and fresh, you know, maple leaves, whatever that they can eat, they're not focusing on greenbrier because they don't need it then. They have other options. But later in the season, when all of that stuff has gone away, that's when the greenbrier is hitting, right? So let's say you're scouting in October and you're looking for a place to hunt and you find a white oak tree that's dropping acorns. Okay, that's fantastic for right then. And that's a good place to hunt. But then you find a spot that's just choked in with greenbrier. Well, that's not going to help you in October, but that's really good information to have in December and in January. Little things like, you know, if you're sitting in the woods and you hear a bunch of blue jays raising canes or squirrels barking, there's a reason that's happening, right? So all the little things that you can learn, all of that stuff helps. And I heard someone say that a woodsman should try to know everything there possibly is to know within like a 100-mile radius of their house. And that's never going to happen, but that's what you should try to do. And I think
that is brilliant. I think so. And I love
that. I wish I could take credit for it, John. I do, but I don't remember where I read that at, but I think that's a,
well, you're the first one I've heard say that. I love that. We talk about different things like that, but the way you summarized it all was incredible. It's just, again, that sort of intimate knowledge of biology or just, you know, the quarry that you're going after, right? Love it. Love it. That is such a valuable piece of information. And again, like you said, though, that is kind of hard information to come across.
It is.
Unless it's somebody like you talking about it, then how would anybody, well, they read that your article in Traditional Bowhunter magazine. But I mean, other than that, there isn't, that isn't a big topic for conversation, is it?
No. You know, it's like, like trappers. And I've never, my grandfather used to trap for a living. I've never trapped, but everybody I've ever met who traps is a phenomenal hunter. It's a fun, they're just really, really good at it. You just got to learn to see things, you know. And we're talking about younger hunters and people getting into this later in life. And one of my best friends, he's very outdoorsy, but he's never hunted. And he's kind of getting into it now. And we'll go on hikes or trail runs or something like that. And I've probably mentioned this before, but it kind of hit home with me where, you know, we're jogging along or trail running or whatever, and I'll see something, whether it's a funnel or a rub or whatever, and I'll kind of point it out. And if you and I were walking in the woods, John, and I seen that and I'd pointed it, you'd kind of give me the thumbs up and be like, yeah.
Well, I'd point we would both know.
Yeah, and he's like, what are you looking at? You just don't know what you don't know. But if he, as an analogy, were like, okay, I want to be a better hunter and starts going on YouTube and Googling stuff, not saying that information isn't there, but there's a lot of information there and a lot of it's pretty useless, you know?
So agree.
I think it's just, I would define it as being able to interpret sign, whether that sign is animal tracks or what animals are feeding on or subtle differences in terrain or wind, all of that.
Patterns, yeah, patterns, traffic patterns, absolutely. Seasonal patterns.
Yeah. Someone once told me that, you know, if every time you see an animal do something in the woods, unless they're actively trying to get away from something, there's probably a reason they're right there at that time, you know.
Absolutely.
So go figure out what it is.
Yeah. And you're right about, that's the sort of the bane of social media too. I can't tell you how many posts I see in January, you know, out, you know, scouting for deer. It's like, well, unless you have a season in January, which some places do, it's not going to really do you a lot of good, at least not where we live. Yeah. You know, if you're hunting in September, November, October, November, then the deer aren't there in January, right? So anyways, and vice versa. That's interesting. What about gear though, Ethan? Like, tell me a little bit about, you know, you've been doing this a lot of years. So talk to me about some of your favorite gear.
You know, ironically, we don't talk about it much, but I am, when it comes to hunting and like my bow and arrow setups, my combination stuff, I'm not a tinkerer. It's like, this works. That's what I'm using. But when I do a lot of backpacking too, but when it comes to backpacking gear and gear in general, I am kind of a gearhead on some of that stuff. One thing I think is pretty interesting, there's a lot more affordable options that are pretty decent these days. I feel like, let's say 15 years ago, if you wanted a good puffy jacket, you know, you was going to drop some coin. Nowadays, I mean, you can go to Amazon and buy a puffy jacket for $30, and it's not going to be as good as one from, you know, Sitka or First Light or whatever, but it's still pretty good. And if, you know, if you're building up your kit and you're getting into this stuff, you don't have to have the absolute best of everything, you know.
Thank you.
I think that, some pieces of gear are really, really important. Good boots, That's a really, really major deal. Shelter is really, really important, but how important depends on where you live. So if you're hunting with John up in Canada, shelter is going to probably be a lot more important than if you're hunting in Southern Colorado. Right. So you kind of tailor that stuff. And, you know, that's something I told my son-in-law is he's wanting to really get into hunting and spending time in the backcountry and that type of thing.
You know,
get what you can now, and then later you can sell it and reinvest or whatever, you know. So, like, I don't know if you can see much of the background, but I've got a little room here in my basement that's my office / gear closet, and it looks like a outfitter, you know, exploded down here.
It's a retail store of older stuff. I see. Yeah.
But it didn't start out that way. You know, it takes a while to build all that stuff. And I think it's more important to spend your money wisely and go hunt and dial into the rest of that stuff later. For bows in particular, the advice I give everyone, if they're wanting to start shooting a traditional bow, is go buy a Samick Sage.
The second person I've had on the show saying the same thing.
Yeah. You know, they're not expensive. You can get
Three Rivers sells them, right?
Absolutely. You can go buy a Samick Sage and not have a lot invested in it. You can learn to shoot, learn what you like before you go drop a lot of money on something custom or what have you. And I've never killed anything that I couldn't kill with a Samick Sage, you know, and you can get a light set of limbs. You can learn to shoot and then you can bump up later, you know, whereas if you go out and buy a, whatever, you know, Black Widow or Blacktail or Tall Tines or Zipper or whatever. Those are great bows. But if you haven't been doing it very long and you get this bow and then a year later you figure out that you really like bows that are a little longer or you like bows that are more mass weight or whatever, you know, now you're not $1,500, $1,700 down the rabbit hole. You know, you've got time.
The wrong rabbit hole.
Yeah. Yeah. You can kind of figure out what you like. So I think it's important to focus on the important stuff and the other stuff. Just kind of get what you can when you can and just go hunt, you know?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I actually wrote an article about that and just was looking at it today, actually. I shared it over on Pinterest, you know, because not enough people had seen it. But it was just, you know, cheap gear hacks, you know, that you can get, like even secondhand stuff.
Sure.
But anyways, I always go back to, and I don't know if this is the right advice. I used to be interested in Everest and the guys, Mallory and those guys that climbed Everest back in the 20s. And I think about those guys climbing back then with leather and canvas and cotton and they didn't have any of these things that we have today. And yet they were out doing those things. Of course they died, but
right. Yeah. You may not be as comfortable, you know, if you're hunting a pair of blue jeans, but you can still go hunting a pair of blue jeans.
They still did it. Yeah,
absolutely.
Anyways. Yeah, that's awesome, man. What's next on your radar as far as hunting?
Well, Tom Jenkins at Zipper Bows called me a few weeks ago and he said, "Hey, what's your plans for September?" And I was like, "Well, I'm going to go to a PBS hunt down in Georgia for North Georgia for bear. Oh, it's a 3-day weekend deal late September." And he's like, "Well, we got a high country mule deer hunt planned. If, I need somebody to go with because one of the guys we was going with has had some health issues." And I said, "Well, I guess I'm going to go high country mule deer hunting." So we put in for it, and the units we put in for, we have a pretty high chance of getting drawn. There's probably not a lot of 200-inch mule deer walking around, but I could totally care less. I'm looking for a mule deer buck. So that's kind of on the radar now. And we'll be hunting, of course, whitetails around here. And bear hunting around here is we've got a fair amount of bear, but it's we can't bait, and you're really just kind of hoping a bear comes by. You know, you can't really pattern them.
Yeah, there's no hot spots.
No, not at all.
We're sort of in that same boat. I mean, where I go to hunt bears, I don't know. It's the same. I mean, it's just, I've talked about this in other shows as well. It's such a huge area, right? So I think we have 10 bears, or no, one bear per 10 square kilometers.
Wow.
So what is that like?
Not many.
But anyways, we found a few hot spots over the years, which is exactly what you were talking about with, you know, woodsmanship or just being observant, right? So over the years, we've collected these patterns. So I have a pretty good idea where they hang out if I spend enough days in that area, I should be able to see one. But yeah. Anyways, and then I was just talking with Lander the other day. He's trying to squeeze me in for late season up in BC. Nice. Now, his situation is intense because they have the mountains to contend with. So these bears come down out of the mountains, mm-hmm. down into the valley bottoms where it's green. And gosh, he's just into bears all the time. Some of the stories he has where they're stuck, you know, like it's literally, if you mess up a stalk, you don't worry about it. Yeah. There's another one 10 minutes from now, right?
Yeah, so. They got a lot of bear up there. He's got some cool adventures he's had over the years as well. Just
oh, gosh, yeah. Well, that's all interesting, Ethan. Is there anything else that you wanted to touch on? Like, point us in the direction. How do we get a hold of Ethan, and where do we see what you guys, more of what you're talking about? And
well, Dalton does all of the social media stuff because I kind of hate it. I tried for a while, and I just I usually tell friends if you post stuff and I don't like it, don't get your feelings hurt because I'm not on it very much at all. But the podcast is on all the major podcast platforms. Dalton does a phenomenal job with editing and putting together videos. I am terrible at video. And I've told the story before, but the first Dalton, when we started doing this, Dalton's like, man, you got to get a camera. And I was like, it's not my thing. I'm not doing that. He's like, no, you got to get a camera. So it's like, all right, pick me out a camera that's really easy to operate and I'll do it. So the first time I went in the woods with it ever in my life, I killed a turkey and filmed it. And I thought, man, there's nothing to this. Well, it was about five animals later when I remembered to turn the camera back on. So I'm not good at it at all. And it's cool, but it's kind of a pain. But Dalton does a good job at that.
Oh, dude, I hear you. Okay, so hang on. So where do we find you over on YouTube?
On YouTube, The Stick Boys.
Good.
And there was actually a bunch of videos there that we lost a while back because when Dalton started doing this, he started it as a project for college.
Oh, really?
Yeah, him and Ethan Henson, their professor was like, I don't want to read papers, but I want you to tell me about what you're passionate about, so go film it. So that's what they started doing, and then they graduated college, and a decade later, they lost the email address, so everything was lost. So there's not.
I heard that story.
Not as many videos as there used to be, but there's still quite a few on there. And we try to do the woodsmanship stuff. That's like I said, we try to focus on that because we kind of geek out on it. But that's what's going to help people more than anything else.
Yeah. Well, there you are, and I'm not surprised. I'm already subscribed to you. Good, so yeah, good deal.
Yeah, Dalton's got a lot of really good hunting up there. Every year, him and his dad are like, "Man, you need to come out here and hunt." I'm like, "Yeah, I know I do. I get stubborn." And it's funny that first year I sent him a, I don't remember what it was. I recorded something and sent it. And he's like, "Man, you need to film all the deer you see that you're not going to shoot." And I'm like, "Brother, that's it here. If we don't see a lot of deer here, our numbers are pretty low here. It's just just big timber. Yeah. It's rugged. Not a lot of agriculture. There's just, you know, I think there's 2 to 4 deer per square mile here. And then in the middle part of the state, it's more like 25 deer per square mile.
Time sure flies it seems like you're talking to old friends whenever I do this, especially when I talk to traditional guys, yeah, bow hunting guys.
Absolutely.
So anyways, I sure appreciate your time with all of this. And some of the things that you mentioned in this podcast were outstanding ideas that I hope people take away and think about for a minute, because I often talk about the layers mm-hmm. of hunting, the layers of enjoyment. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one of the things that you touched on when you were talking about, you know, woodsmanship is so enjoyable to, you know, figure out all of those little things. And you said you'll never be able to figure it all out, which is true. And it's also the beauty of it, right?
Absolutely.
That's outstanding, bud. Well, thanks so much for your time, Ethan. I really appreciate
it. Yeah, absolutely. And we would love to have you on our podcast as well. You're on the list. So we have to schedule a time and get you to come on.
Okay. Good. Yeah. I will come and embarrass myself all you want.
Hey, man, you know what me and Dalton always say? You're always going to seem quite a bit more intelligent than you really are because you're talking to us. So you'll be good. You'll be good.
Thank you for listening to the Food Afield podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. The Food Afield podcast is created by me, John Schneider. Much of the music that goes into the show is created by my friend Kevin Coswin. And thank you also to Emma for the intro before every episode. And thank you so much to the listeners of the show. We couldn't do this without you. Be sure to head on over to Instagram. You can check out our account there, Food Afield Podcast. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes stories and photographs that go on there. But if you really want the behind-the-scenes stuff, then head on over to the website, foodafieldpodcast.com. Check out the members' benefits. We have member-exclusive articles on the blog that really go behind the scenes and tell stories of the different hunts and different adventures that we're on. We also have recipes there, how-to articles, all sorts of stuff. We really try to make it valuable for our members. Don't forget to leave a review whenever you get a chance on whatever platform you're listening to the show. And thank you so much for sharing the Food Afield podcast with your family and friends.